You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us.
On today's podcast, we're going to give a homestead update. We have been extremely busy, so we wanted to share kind of a few things that are going on here. We also have a workshop coming up July 18th here in Cocalalla, Idaho. You can go to our website, sovereignsunrise.com, to find out more about that. And that's Sovereign Sunrise. Sunrise is S-O-N-R-I-S-E.com, where we're going to go ahead and put on that workshop. And we've gotten some very positive feedback, and we have several as far as people wanting to go and all of that. So that's encouraging. And we decided to also go ahead and put on some workshops in August, September, and October, as long as there's demand for it. So we'll see how all that turns out. And again, we'll talk about a homestead update today. But first, I want to talk through our worldview segment. And I know it's been in the news over and over and over again, but I wanted to address the Rachel Dolezal situation. You know, if you recall, she was the leader of the NAACP Spokane chapter, Spokane, Washington chapter. She's been in the news lately for falsifying information. She claims to be black. That is not her race. And it's not just, and I'm going to talk about this here in just a minute as far as transracial, biracial, all those kinds of ideas that stem from our present culture. But it was the falsifying of information about who she is, and it's more so about the types of claims that she's made. I mean, if we can't trust her in, you know, who she says she is, who she says her father is, things like that, how can we trust the accusations legal accusations she's made against people about discrimination and everything else? It's very clear that she is a dishonest person. The level of deception is very high with her. So I want to talk about that for just a minute. I'm not going to belabor the point at all. So she's obviously been on the Today Show and been interviewed over and over and over again. She self-identifies as black. She identifies as black. Okay, she's not. She doesn't have African-American in her. That's not her ethnicity. Now, yeah, she identifies as black, and that's an important point to this. She did resign this last week from the Spokane, Washington branch of the NAACP, and she also lost her position as a part-time African studies instructor at a local university. And there were some other implications to this. So, you know, it's really set off a national debate over racial identity. So she's 37, and she has described herself as black or partly black for years. And all of this, I don't know, I can't tell you where it stems from or anything like that. But I mean, the bottom line is she's deceiving people. Now, she has also described herself as transracial or biracial. Now, that's a very important point. So I want to talk about that. Transracial, okay? Obviously, we have seen the LGBT community make huge strides. You know, pretty much lesbian, gay, bisexual, they have a solid footing, obviously, in their agenda. It's just about to be codified in law by the Supreme Court, I'm sure. But then now what we see, the big thing now is transgenderism, you know, with Bruce Jenner coming out as Caitlyn Jenner and all of that. Well, now what we see is simply an extension of that ideology, and that's transracial. So she identifies as black. Okay, and listen, if we are to be consistent as a culture, we have to grant her that. She identifies as Black, then we must accept that. Okay, now, do I believe that to be true? No, of course not. It's ludicrous, but I think it demonstrates the total depravity, just the idiocy of our culture. I mean, that's just, it's really quite disturbing. But if we're going to be consistent, we need to understand. The philosophical question is, why not transracial? Why can't she identify as Black? And the answer is, you're right, there's no reason why she can't identify as Black according to our culture. We have a degenerate culture where there is no absolute truth. Okay, and when you do not rest on absolute truth, in the end, anything goes. And we see that here. So there is no absolute truth according to our culture because they suppress it. Anything goes. So if our culture would be consistent, they would not condemn her for identifying as Black. Now, that is separate from the legal issues of making accusations and misrepresenting herself to individuals. She should be held accountable for that. And I think this is all ludicrous. But the reality is that she is doing nothing but demonstrating the absurdity of our present culture. Okay, that's what she's doing. She self-identifies as Black. Well, then we should recognize her as Black. You know, if she self-identifies as whatever, we need to identify her as whatever. Okay, again, if we carry out our present absurd culture to its logical conclusions, we have to recognize anything. If there is no absolute truth, and anybody can self-identify as anything, then we need to recognize that. To me, it's important because it, once again, it demonstrates where we are as a culture, which is not good. Okay, so as a Christian, how do we respond to this? Well, look, I'm not out condemning her or anything else, but we do need to answer the fool according to its folly on occasion. Okay, there are times when we don't do that because we don't want to become like the fool, but there are times when we do answer the fool in order to close their mouth. And I think this is an important point, not directed at her specifically, although I certainly feel that she should be held accountable for the misrepresentation in certain aspects, and certainly if there was false accusations, that she should be held accountable for that. But this is a perfect point for Christians to understand and point out that the absurdity of the culture. What we need to be doing is pointing out that there is absolute truth, that there are absolute moral standards that can be found in the scriptures. So we need to hold fast to the truth and continue to speak it boldly, but with reverence and respect, not name calling or anything like that. That should be our response. On to our main topic today, which is a homestead update. It's June 18th, 2015, and wow, it has been a busy couple of months now, and it will continue to be a busy couple of months, and really all of our summer months during our establishment time here, and then of course just regular homesteading during the summer months is always busy, but we're particularly busy right now, and I'm here with my lovely wife, Monica.
Hello.
So, you would agree with me, obviously, that it has been busy.
Busy. We're going morning until evening, sometimes later than we'd like.
6 days a week.
6 days a week.
Although we did, we finally said at one point, we need to take some time. And we took everybody. We went on a hike.
Yep. We went to one of the local state parks. There's so many state parks and hikes and lakes and places to see around here that we're going to try to do this a couple times a month during the summer.
During the summer.
Even though it's hard because we wake up going, okay, we got these things to do, we're taking time away. Let's go have some fun for a little while.
Yeah. So we're sitting here. We're going to talk about a homestead update. We've got several things to go through. And the first thing here on the list, we talk about a pasture expansion and basically paddock expansion. So we've done a lot of work in this area, and we talked about it briefly in the last homestead update, but I want to kind of expand upon it because we've really been talking about some important aspects of this. When you set up systems, mm-hmm. you want to build redundancies and resiliency into those systems. Otherwise, it can become a nightmare.
Yeah. Well, because on paper, you go, okay, this looks like a really great system and it's going to work really, really well. And you forget about, you know, obstinate animals. Right. You don't think about the fact that they're going to try and destroy everything that they come in contact with.
Yeah.
And dealing with the kids trying to do something, and Lindy coming back going,
goat kids,
you know, like, I can't keep the goats in, and they're, you know, doing this.
They're
and
pushing through because they want to go get to that little,
their little grassy spot over there. Yeah.
Paddock over there. And that's not where we want to move them.
Yeah. So half the animals are here, half the animals are there. Yeah. And, you know, just trying to like rodeo them in.
Right. Now, if we could, if we had all of our sheep and goats together, it would be easier.
Yeah.
And some of this has been working out beautifully. Like, when I go out and watch Lindy move the animals at the end of the day, in most cases, should they just follow her? Like, no problem. You know, she's just got a little snack or a little bit of hay, and they're just, boom, right there. But it's these little things that can throw it way off.
Yeah. Well, and we have to keep the kids, the goat kids, separated from their mom at this point. Even though they're way past being weaned, they won't stop nursing on her when they're there with her.
Yes. So that's kind of our challenge.
And
that
they steal our milk.
They steal our milk. That's true.
Yeah.
Right now we have, we've expanded. So we have 9 kind of fixed paddocks and with cross fencing and all of that. That we're able to use. And then we have what we call the ROTW paddock. Well, that's the rest of the world. In other words, it's free range. Now, of course, we were selective in who we let free range. We'll do that with our goats. We do that with the goat kids.
Yeah, we let them free range a lot.
Quite a bit. So really we have 10 paddocks. But and we are going to continue to expand on that. But that has given us some flexibility and is allowing us to manage the pasture better.
Yeah.
And we're able to, you know, let areas rest properly. Although right. I'm still not quite happy, but, you know, we're making slow progress here.
Well, and part of it is it's been so dry. We didn't have a real deep snowy winter, so that water didn't come down. And then it's been really dry in the spring, and so the grass isn't growing at the same rate I think it would if we had a lot of rain.
Yeah, yeah. So we had probably less than 50% snowfall from the average annual snowfall. And then we had a dry spring, which normally is really wet here.
Yeah, it's been very, very dry. Although I have to say, I appreciated the less snow as sort of our introductory, like, okay, this we can handle it
kind of
winter.
Right. So we ended up plowing probably 4 times.
Yeah.
When we would normally probably need to at least double that.
Yeah, and we had neighbors come and help too, which was real nice. So.
Yeah. Okay, so that talks about our pasture expansion, paddock shift. Again, overall, it's going really well. And you know, in some areas, you can really tell when we really took the time to make the swinging gates or mm-hmm. whatever, because we have a little bit of an intricate system.
Yeah.
Because of the way our land is. That has worked out really well. In other areas where maybe we did something a little quicker, you know, causing us to have to work on it.
Right. And again, I think this is something we always talk about, flexibility. If something isn't working, try to come up with a better system so that in the long run, it's saving you time and it's not so intensive that it becomes a real burden.
Right.
You know, you want it to be sustainable and simple and not so complicated that nobody can figure it out.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so the next item on our list is the food forest expansion. And it's kind of funny because, you know, when we've showed several people our food forest, and most people are very fascinated by it. It's like, what is this thing called a food forest? And it's kind of funny because when you look at it right now, it doesn't look much like a forest, and there's not much food growing in there.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
But But what, you know, what I tell people is I can see it. Mm-hmm. I know you can see it.
Mm-hmm.
And other people, I think, can see it. But when you just think, okay, 2-3 years from now, when all of those trees and bushes and plants are developing and, you know, they're 10-15 feet tall and they're producing fruits and nuts, you know, a lot of them will be producing by that point. It's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
And so we put, since the last homestead update, we completed the fencing, we completed the gate some of the stairs.
One set of stairs, yeah.
We got one more to go. And then did a lot more plantings.
Yes. We have a lot of trees and bushes, and actually things are looking really, really good in there. Like leaves are coming out. A couple of them are not looking so great, but that's a couple out of how many things did we plant in there?
Well, we've easily put 100.
Yeah. Trees, bushes, and support species.
In the ground up there in just that, that food forest area.
Yeah.
So we're excited to see how that develops over time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Since the last update, one of the things that we've been hitting really hard, and rightly so, is water.
Water.
And that has always been our plan, and that always needs to be probably the number one concern for any homesteader, even anybody with land, is water. And so, unfortunately, I mean, because it's been exceptionally dry and everything else, and we'll talk about some of the problems that we've had. But we've gotten a lot done with regards to water.
Yeah.
So we dug ponds. We put in two more ponds, rented an excavator to do it. So this was not just a small, tiny little pond. This is a pretty decent sized pond with a dam wall and you know, significant construction.
Yeah.
And all of that. We put in swales. We put in a couple hundred yards worth of swales, and that's just a water harvesting ditch that's on contour, so it's meant to capture the water, slow spread, and soak it. So we've done those things. We have been working with springs, and I want to be careful to call them springs because they're more like seeps, but we did recently find a spring, or at least what we think is going to be a good spring on our property that's nice and wet and has a real light flow to it right now, even though it's really dry. So that's great. So we're going to do some research into that. So I'm going to go dig it out a little bit and see how it develops over a little bit of time to see if it's worth developing. So there's that. So there's the ponds, the swells, the springs, and then rainwater catchment. So
yeah.
We set up some
on both the barn and the house.
Right. So we only have about half. We're only catching off about half the house right now.
Mm-hmm.
But that's working out great. In fact, it's working out really great since we'll talk about our well problems here in just a minute.
Yeah, and we haven't had that much rain, but we still have water in the storage,
in our water tanks.
Which is nice. That's the hard thing about doing projects in the summer when things are so dry. Like we have all these swales cut and it looks dry.
Yeah.
And then we've got a pond, which we hit water as you dug. So it's got some water in there, but our little seasonal creek is dry and our two upper ponds are dry. So it's kind of like, huh.
Right.
You know, they don't look very pondish right now.
Exactly. And in the ideal, you want to dig ponds and then you want them to fill up quickly. But, you know, sometimes you gotta
deal with what you got.
Deal with what you got and go when you can.
Yeah. And it would not be a good idea for us to wait until, oh, the water's finally coming. It's finally raining. It's wet. And now we can start the projects. It's better for us to get everything, all the infrastructure set up, all the earthworks done.
Yeah.
So it's prepared to receive the water when it does start coming.
Right. Exactly. So that's been good. And in fact, it's really interesting how we set up all these systems because to us, water is vital, especially with all the animals we have with the gardens and the food forest and all of that need water. it just the way it all worked out, we recently developed a well problem.
Yes.
You know, which can happen. And so what happened is which I guess what showed up is this murky reddish water.
Yeah.
That showed up. And there's a couple of possibilities, and we talked to some of the locals around here and to find out, you know, some more about this. It could have been just, you know, where the casing goes down. There could have been some buildup on there that knocked loose, and you know, which is giving us some discolored water and things like that. Or the static level on our well could have gone down quite a bit into an area where it stays murky and.
Yeah.
And that's what we think happened.
Yeah. I think it is that because, like you were saying, between our food forest, our little herb garden, and then our annual garden, we were watering
a lot.
A lot.
Yeah.
Have 9 people in our home.
Right. So we, even though we take a lot of water measures
we do.
To reduce our water usage, we have a lot of water needs. Now, on it, I want to talk just real quickly because I have been putting a lot of water into the food forest. And eventually, once a food forest is established, it shouldn't need irrigation. That's the whole point. You want to build a resilient system that doesn't need irrigation. But during establishment, it sometimes is necessary. And for us on our property, it's necessary.
Yeah.
And I don't want to lose all those trees. So we have been putting a lot of water up there, hoping that in a year or two, we don't have to worry about it anymore.
Right.
But right now we are, and we are trying to put a lot of water on the annual garden because everything is so dry.
Yeah, so dry.
So we've been using our well. We've been pushing it.
Yeah.
We've been pushing it, admittedly. So we think that's what happened, that the static level went down low enough to a place where we hit, you know, murky areas.
Yeah, that's part of the reason why, like, if we are able to develop this spring, it will take a big load off of our water use, even for the food forest, because we can irrigate right into the food forest.
Absolutely.
Off the spring.
So in response to that, what we have decided to do is back off, you know, significantly off of our well. Okay, back off significantly off of our well. Now, what are the implications of that? Well, guess what? Just like that, you no longer have a well. And you got to think about that really hard. Now, fortunately, we have put measures in place for that reason, because water is so important. So we have water storage, not a lot, but we have water. So what do? We bring out our water storage, and we're good. We can drink water. We can, you know, use water for cooking and all that. We also have rainwater collection, so we can use that. We can take that water and then filter it. Whether through boiling or just running it through the Berkey.
And what we ended up doing for dishes is getting the rainwater catchment water, boiling it, and then using that to wash the dishes.
Right.
I mean.
So we had a couple of redundant systems in place that although it's, you know, it's challenging, you know, we're okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now we also have a stream. If we had to, we could do that. But that's not what we want to do.
Right.
Because it's a little bit of a distance, and we'd have to pump from it, and, you know, or collect from it, and, you know, it's not the type of system that's super resilient. It takes a lot of manual labor to be able to pull water from streams and get it up to our property. So right now we have rainwater and stored water. And that's fine. So with backing off of the well, what we're hoping is that we'll clear up here shortly, and then we'll be very measured in our usage of it. We need to back off a little bit. So we've kind of found the max of what we can use as far as irrigation and everything else, which is why we've been working so hard in all these other areas.
Yes, exactly.
And we share that. We share our problems that so people can learn from them. So we have that well problem. We're working on it, and fortunately we had some systems in place to counteract it. Now on to the next problem, the garden problem, the annual garden.
Yeah, well, the problem with the annual garden has been we did so much planning and starts. Half the garden I think we did from seed because that's just, you know, best for them to be sown straight into the ground after the last frost. And but we had a massive failure of germination because of the lack of water, which is the reason we increased the watering of the garden after we realized we thought that the seeds probably dried up or didn't even germinate because they weren't moist enough. The ground was pretty dry.
Right. Even though we're doing heavy mulch and all that.
Right. Yeah. So I did several more trays of starts, and then our puppy got into them. So
good lesson learned there.
Yeah.
Protect your starts. And I mean, they're precious.
They are. It was very frustrating because they were just starting to sprout, and some of them were able to salvage, but not a lot. And so we're going to do our best to get some things in there. But again, our annual garden is nice, but it's not what in the long run that we're hoping to rely on.
Right. We put more, and we've said this over and over again, we put more emphasis on our perennials versus our annuals, even though we like annuals and we want to develop that, and we will.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and if this totally fails, we'll hit it again in the fall.
Yeah.
We'll hit those crops in the fall. You know.
I'll plant more in July. We can do broccoli and Brussels cabbage. Sprouts and cabbage and those types of things. Even kale. I can plant kale.
And we can do that even later.
And we planted some rhubarb too in the food forest.
Yeah, and our perennials are most of them are doing well.
We've got strawberries, raspberries.
We've even got some of the blueberry bushes we've planted starting to.
And some of the things in the garden did do well. Like we've got lots of peas and beans, and we have squash and pumpkin coming up and a few tomato plants survived and some peppers.
Yeah. No, it's certainly not a total loss. We just
not as much as we had planned and anticipated.
That's right. And so that's a good lesson learned there is that you cannot, because this is what a lot of people do, is that that's their thing, their annual garden.
Yeah.
And if that thing fails,
they've got nothing else.
You've got nothing else. And, you know, whereas suppose we've got elderberry and currants and blackberry and raspberry and strawberries and in a few years we'll have lots of nuts and things like that.
Apples and pears and
And we've already got apples and hopefully some pears this year and plums and things like that. So again, we have always emphasized perennials over annuals, but you know, we keep working. We keep working.
Yeah. And again, this is one of those things on a homestead that you can't guarantee the rain you're gonna get. And you have to be, it can't destroy your entire plan or future if somehow your annual garden goes kaput.
That's right. Like so you build in resiliency, you build in redundancy. For us, we overplant our perennials big time. And I think that's going to serve us well in the long run.
Yeah.
All right. So the next problem on the list.
Yeah, we got a lot of problems.
We made mistakes.
We're doing so many projects that you're bound to have a lot of problems. If we were only doing one project, the most we could have is one problem.
Yeah. And of note here, and this is not to toot our own horn, a lot of these problems were simply overcome because we built in resiliency and redundancy.
Yeah.
And this is what we're trying to get other people to do as well. Okay, so we have decided to move into the pastured poultry realm.
Yes.
So we're going to start selling pastured poultry. Okay. So, you know, what do I mean? I mean, we're going to raise meat chickens. They are raised on pasture or grass. They get fresh grass every day. In fact, we move them in tractors, which is just a movable pen. So they get a fresh spot every single day. They're supplemented with feed with our all-stock feed, which is non-GMO feed. So that's, you know, that's important to us. So we're raising what we call pastured poultry. It's not organic in that we aren't seeking that label.
No.
It's simply a government label that you pay someone else for the label. Agree to do certain practices, which we do all those practices.
Right.
But I have no interest in being beholden to some USDA label.
Correct. They're out in the sun every day. They're on grass or catching bugs and digging. And
so it'll be great.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. So we came into this opportunity. We were able to buy a lot of chicks for a very good price. And then we expanded our chicken tractor operation. So we had a chicken tractor that was working well. Mm-hmm. In fact, we're raising chickens and turkeys in it. Those are getting ready to go pretty soon, the processing. And so we expanded that, and we built three more chicken tractors, and a fourth is on the way to be able to run this operation, or at least this test bed that we're doing right now. But what we did wrong is that we made the chicken tractor. It's constructed well, but the welded wire that we use is a little too big.
Yeah.
So for the first couple of weeks, when you put the chicks out there from the brooder at, 3 to 4 weeks old, they can get through that welded wire.
They're too small.
And I thought we could get away with it, and we can't.
No, so, they walk right out.
So what we have is we came up with a great and awesome fix.
Yes, it's very attractive.
It's awesome. Cardboard and duct tape.
Cardboard and duct tape. On the sides. Because if there isn't duct tape on the project, it hasn't been done right.
Yeah. So that, we'll have to deal with that for a little while here unless we get some small chicken wire.
Yeah.
Which I'll probably do just so we don't have this problem in the future.
Right. Because we're going to be hopefully running
multiple chicks. Meat runs of pasture poultry.
Yeah.
So we had that problem to deal with, and so there's some comic situations
chasing around little chicks all over the food forest
with nets and things like that.
Yes. So. Fortunately, it is not us though.
That's true.
The children.
Yeah. So they are chasing. Yeah. So that was an issue, and that really kind of talks about some of the things that. That are happening on the homestead, specifically outside. We got a couple things to talk about inside.
Yeah.
So the first thing is you kind of experimented with raw yogurt for a while, or you have been using raw yogurt.
Yeah, well, I've been using raw milk, and then I've been bringing it up to kind of a pasteurized temperature, between 160 and 170, and then letting it cool to 110, and then adding the starter culture and all of that. Well, I wanted to do a true raw yogurt, using the raw milk, not heating it up to pasteurized and just going up to the straight 110. The yogurt tastes fine, but it's the whey doesn't fully separate like it does on the pasteurized, bringing it up to the pasteurized temperature. And so it ends up being a very runny yogurt drink rather than, it's like more like lassi. In the Indian restaurants.
Okay.
Rather than an actual yogurt. And I tried doing a separation. So to make a Greek style, you can take your regular yogurt, kind of dump it into a cheesecloth and let more of the whey come off, and you've got a nice thick yogurt. I tried doing that, and this stuff just started going, all of it going through the cheesecloth. Like, I didn't have anything left. And so it was kind of like, So though it tasted fine, and we ended up eating it all, or I should say drinking it all, I'm not going to do that again. I'm going to stick with bringing it up to pasteurized and letting it cool back down. And it makes a more solid,
right? Okay,
edible yogurt.
Okay, so the experiment, it's fine, but you want to go back?
Yeah, I mean, if I want drinkable yogurt, which if I was going to make yogurt pops or something, I would do it that way.
Okay.
Because then you could add the fruit, and it's still, it's got all the really, really good probiotics, and you're dealing with raw milk still, and so it has all of the active enzymes and things like that. I don't know if freezing ruins that, but
okay.
I don't know.
Okay, so that's cool. And now we had an unusual heat wave come through. I mean, we hit a couple weeks ago. We were hitting 90s.
Nineties.
Yeah. This was like, I don't know. We might have even hit a record there on one day, but it was bumping up against the all-time record high.
Yeah, it was very hot.
So 90s. During the day, we talk, we don't have air conditioning.
No.
So we don't talk about the strategies we've used to cool the home.
Well, the one thing that you did was ordered all the cami netting that we put out across our entire deck, which we have windows almost all the way across, windows and doors.
Right, so, on the south side.
On the south side. So the sun comes up on that side and it just shines all the way until late afternoon.
Makes a nice little greenhouse area.
It would make a great greenhouse, yeah. But as far as heating up the – it heats up the home.
I'm sorry. My mistake. It's all on the east side, but it gets some southern exposure, so it's not quite facing east. But it's more east, but you still get all that morning sun and a little bit of that late morning to afternoon sun.
You do. It gets hot in the house.
Oh, yeah, it does.
So not only did you put up the camo netting, but we also have kind of a screen that we can drop down in front of our living room window, plus the what are those? Not curtains, blinds. But like curtains. Blinds. They're curtains.
Okay.
the big curtains in our living room.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, which are heavy. I mean, they're they can block out a lot of sun, and then we have the blinds in our bay window. We try and open up the windows early in the morning and the doors early in the morning. Get breezes moving through, and then try and pull out and reverse the fans in our windows as the heat is coming in the house and trying to get out.
And then up in at the highest point of the house, you've got where, obviously the heat is traveling, you've got it pushing out.
Right, a reverse fan. Yeah. We keep that door open, and the heat will just kind of move up stairs.
That worked pretty well.
Yeah, it did.
That was fine.
Yeah, I think when you put up the camo netting, that made a huge difference. Mm-hmm. It probably helped keep the house 3 to 5 degrees cooler just in the one room.
Yeah.
And we're not cooking. We're not using the oven. We're trying not to use the oven. We're trying to use the crock pots outside. You got a barbecue, so you started barbecuing. That's also helping.
Even if we're boiling water, we do it outside.
Yeah.
So that's part of it, is you remove heat sources from inside. Little things like doing most either cooking or eating more cold type.
Yeah. Salads and fruit salads and things like that. And then the other thing is that we're trying not to use our dryer, even though our basement is actually pretty cool. 70 to 72. It feels really, really nice down there. We don't want to heat that up by using the dryer. And so we're taking advantage of the sun and the warm weather to dry our clothes outside.
Right. Which of course also saves energy and all that. So that's great stuff. All right. So That's kind of the things that we wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. Can you think of anything else we need to cover?
I don't think so. Just we have a homestead workshop coming up.
That's right, July 18th. And we added workshops in August, September, and October. So you can, once again, you can go to the website, sovereignsunrise.com, and that's sunrise, sonrise.com, and find out the schedule there.
And sign up and...
Yeah. So we've got quite a few people signed up for July, but we still have some slots.
Yep.
Open for that. So that's going to be great. I think the fact that we hit these homesteading workshops from not only a permaculture type approach, but a preparedness minded approach. So that's why we really emphasize the redundant systems and the resilient systems.
Yes. Don't put all your eggs in one basket.
That's right. So, all right. Very good. Our scripture for today is Philippians 4:8. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.